The last Friday in August 2014, obviously 100 years after the onset of World War One, we're actually here on location with Midweek Drive from Siren FM and Southside Broadcasting at the Cartoon Museum in London, and I'm delighted to be able to be joined by the legend that is Professor Jane Chapman. Good to see you as ever, Jane.
Hello, Alex. Hi.
One of the key things about why we're here is because you are responsible for one really significant exhibition that's here.
Yes, I mean, I'm not responsible for all of this exhibition, it's a very large one, but for a section of it that represents the findings of our original research from a research project at Lincoln University called Comics and the World Wars, a Cultural Record. So the project covers both World Wars. This exhibition is for World War One, and this time next year we're having an exhibition here at the Cartoon Museum for World War Two, where some of our findings for that will be exhibited.
I've been fortunate enough to have a little wander around the museum already and have been very impressed with the level of information and indeed the content, because what you've actually got here is a lovely balance between views of World War One that were taken from the 1970s, in particular Pat Mills' work for Charlie's War and Battle Action magazine, but also a lot of material that comes across at the time itself.
Yes, that's right. I mean, we concentrated on material created during the First World War itself and in recuperating and bringing to public knowledge multi-panel cartoons and regular single-panel cartoons from newspapers that the soldiers produced themselves at the trenches. Now, some people have heard of the Wipers Times. That, in fact, didn't have any cartoons. There was a BBC drama on it, an excellent drama on it. But they produced, there were over 800. Others, and the Germans produced them, the French produced them, or the Dominions, the Aussies, the Canadians were very prolific, and of course the British, different regiments. So it's a whole mine of information that we've been able to write about, and we've written the information entries that you referred to, and found the pictures from the period.
We're going to be joined very shortly by the curator of the museum, Anita O'Brien, and I believe Richard Fitzwilliams will hopefully be joining us as well. I know, Jane, you'll have to leave us sometime during our audio promenade, but hopefully in a few seconds we'll get a few words with Anita O'Brien and be able to touch base there. We mentioned we're going to be joined by the museum curator extraordinaire. That would be Anita O'Brien. Anita, good to see you and meet you after our telephonic link a few weeks ago.
And you too, Alex.
This is a splendid place. I mean, it's like a magical Aladdin's cave of sequential storytelling and graphic narratives.
Well, we try to do our best in a small space.
And clearly, we've just been speaking with Jane, who's still with us. The exhibition that Jane was, again, very much the coordinator of in terms of putting things together, is that going well?
Yes, we're planning to have a great evening called Dazzle, Dance and Draw this evening. So we're going to have dancing from, I think, the Turkey Trot and other things from that period. And we've got some of the creators from the 1418 Now project coming to talk about their cartoons. People will be able to buy cocktails from the time and be able to have a hand at drawing their own cartoons as well. So lots of fun this evening, we hope, and lots of people coming to see the exhibition.
Of course, Jane, wearing your BBC coordinator's hat, the educational aspect of the history of the First World War is also crucial, isn't it?
That's right. Oh, I have to just back reference something you said, Alex. Anita is the brains here, not me. And the Cartoon Museum also does a lot of single-panel regular cartoons and contemporary as well as historic ones and caricature. So it's a tremendous place, as you say, and it is an Aladdin's cave. It's wonderful. What was your question?
Just about the educational aspects of events such as this, and yes, obviously putting the exhibition together in the first place.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the way the BBC see it with my work with them on the First World War and the way I know Anita sees it at the Cartoon Museum and the way I see it, I agree, is that cartoons and comic strips are an entry into the period. And so often they're very good as a point of access for children, for adults who don't know anything about the period and are fascinated by what they see and want to learn more. So they're very accessible as a medium, and I think that's tremendous.
Anita, we're currently looking at a wonderful mural put together by Steve Bell, presumably. At least he has a sign there with the wonderful no pictures of the Almighty and a whole range of things there. That's a wonderful entry into the exhibition.
It's a collaboration, actually. It was put together by, I've lost track of how many artists, I think probably about seven or eight. So we've got Steve Bell, We've got Chris Riddell, who draws for The Observer, Dave Brown, who draws for The Independent, Peter Brooks from The Times, Martin Rosen, who draws for lots of different publications, Hunt Emerson, and then some young manga artists. And this was created when we opened here in 2006. And so there are lots of different references, some pastiches of Gilray's famous Plum Pudding in Danger, also references to The Lion and the Unicorn, looking slightly bedraggled, one holding a pen and the other a palette and brush, and also references to Michelangelo's...
Of course, the classic.
Yes, the classic. And, of course, that's a sort of... An interesting meeting of the two meanings of the word cartoon, the historical reference to a drawing for which the basis of a painting or tapestry, which is the classical meaning, and the contemporary meaning a satirical or humorous drawing. So, in a way, the cartoonists are bringing it all together. And, it's a lot of fun, and lots of people have their photograph taken standing in the doorway, as you can imagine.
I'm not surprised.
Yes.
I sense a photo opportunity coming up with yourself and Jane in a few moments, actually. But I was fascinated and pleased to see that the work of Cruikshank also involves you, one of the early satirists, one of the early popular cartoonists, really.
Oh, hugely popular. When Dickens started as a writer, he was actually known as the Cruikshank of writers. And that really tells you, Cruikshank's place in the art of the time. And a few years ago we did an exhibition on drink called Drink and Ink and the Bottle, and we showed his Worship of Bacchus, which is this massive creation, which was originally an oil painting, which the Tate now have, and which they displayed a few years ago. It's not brought out very often because it is about the size of a wall. It is truly enormous. But then he also did a print version, which actually is I think more successful, and was initially supposed to make him a lot of money to show people the evils of drink, and it showed all the different stages of life and different situations and what flowed from people becoming drunk and so on. And we had to produce a guide for it because it was just so complex that people just couldn't find their way around it. And of course he also did two very famous series called The Bottle and The Drunkard's Children. And again, it's, you mentioned narrative storytelling, and those are really key stories. His father died of drink, and he also indulged himself and supposedly then went dry later in his life. But after he died, they did find quite a stash in his cellar. So we're not quite clear whether he genuinely gave it up or whether he remained a secret drinker.
I like to refer to the aspects when I'm talking to the Level 1 reporting continuity and change students as early public information films, but without the film, obviously, and based on a graphic narrative.
Actually, that's a good point. I used to lecture on the origins of documentary, and I would take it back to Hogarth as the first sequential cartoons in the series, like The Rake's Progress and The Harlot's Progress. And coincidentally, there's an exhibition of Hogarth starting here soon. But I just wanted to say about another thing which is coming up, which is very relevant to the First World War. There's a number of speakers at the Cartoon Museum in the evenings, me included. My talk is on the 1st of October, so I hope you're going to come back for that, Alex.
Absolutely essential. I must work through that. Anita, if we can stay with you, and obviously James, with your little audio promenade. I think Richard should hopefully be on his way, but we'll just have to progress in any way, shape or form from that point of view. But once again, you're listening to Southside Broadcasting and Siren FM on location at the Cartoon Museum, and the location, of course, is Little Russell Street.
That's right. We're parallel to Great Russell Street, where the British Museum is. So if people head towards the British Museum and just be aware that one street down, they'll find the Cartoon Museum beside the Plough pub. And so just literally about 50 yards from the British Museum, and they found us.
We're now looking at a wonderful sign which says Never Again, World War One in cartoon and comic art. Obviously nice to see University of Lincoln branded there. Jane, just share with us what this is about. You obviously mentioned the Arts and Humanities Research Council. I know you have to leave us shortly, but just talk to us a little bit about what we're seeing here.
Yeah, well, we've got a 3.5-4 year now, it's been extended, project funded by the Arts and Humanities Research Council to look at comics during the First and Second World War to see if they're a cultural record of the period. So although we do look at some comics that are produced about events like the First World War later, by and large we concentrate on stuff that was produced at the time. And we have found thousands of original examples, many of them languishing in archives where people have forgotten all about them. And that's the case with the First World War stuff here, which forms part of this exhibition. The exhibition is bigger than just our contribution, but ours is particularly from the War Reserve Collection of Cambridge University Library. The story there, very briefly, is a wonderful one. When the First World War broke out, a lot of people said it would be over by Christmas, as many people will know. But the archivist at Cambridge thought it would go on. And so he put the word out internationally to everybody he could think of, saying, send us your ephemera, your bits and pieces that otherwise you would chuck away, and in any language, anything. So they have the biggest First World War collection in the world of ephemera, but things like cigarette cards, postcards, posters, documents, newspapers, the lot. And so I've spent 2 years now combing it for cartoons, and particularly multi-panel cartoons. And some of the things we've found and have written about are exhibited here at the Cartoon Museum in the Never Again exhibition.
I know you have to leave us in a few moments to sort out a variety of bits and pieces, but we can welcome that legend. It's Richard Fitzwilliams, our ace commentator, royal correspondent, indeed film critic. How are you, Richard?
Well, it's it is fascinating to be in the Cartoon Museum, because I was actually here yesterday. I was doing a little bit of a recce, and it's extraordinary to look at cartoons which depict a conflict, which obviously we commemorate the centenary of its beginning. But it is so difficult to get to terms with the horror of it, let alone to see humour in it, which so many of the exhibits here actually in one way or another bring out.
It's a shift from your work normally promoting the Royal Portraiture Society and the Society of Portrait Painters.
Yes, as press consultant for the Royal Society of Portrait Painters, I can assure you that whereas it might be considered by those who didn't like certain of the portraits that they might appear cartoon-like, I mean, I think of one of our members, Whistler, who painted a woman who didn't much like it and went up to him and said that she didn't think it was a great work of art. And he looked back at her and said, maybe not, but then you can hardly call yourself a great work of nature.
And that's where we go back to Cruikshank, really, Anita. It's a classic line.
Well, I suppose,
not much beloved of George III.
No, but it really obviously depends what period you're talking about. And in terms of that period, George III and the if you like, the Georgian age of caricature, the grotesque really was in vogue at the time with people like Cruikshank and Gilray, obviously. Later on, as you move into the latter part of the 19th century, the grotesque is less in favour. It doesn't mean there weren't any people working in that tradition, but less so. I mean, the style of people like Tenniel and others was very much a much more realistic style. Until you get back into, say, the early 20th century, and there is a greater sort of not still the influence of the 19th century is still there, but I suppose that's one of the things that people who love what they call the classic cartoons of, I don't know, people like David Lowe and others, which are beautifully drawn, to their mind, today's cartoonists are too grotesque. But then it really depends on which period you're talking about, what style is in fashion, and how those are emphasized. A lot of today's art is very much inspired by people like Gilray and Cruikshank, and indeed Hogarth, even though Hogarth would never have called himself a caricaturist.
Of course not.
He very carefully said that he represented character rather than caricature. But nevertheless, there is a very strong element of satire in his drawings, and how they are represented may not be particularly grotesque, but he had an understanding of, if you like, the excesses of humanity and how to bring that out in other ways.
Can I just pick up on the point that Richard made about humour out of suffering? That's something that our research team at Lincoln University have studied in great depth, and we've looked at theories and ideas of how people could laugh during this terrible conflict, the First World War. And we've looked in particular at the soldiers' newspapers and the cartoons they did themselves, many of them amateur artists, but there were some professionals who were also soldiers, such as Bruce Bairn's father. And what we believe is that it was a coping mechanism. It was for entertainment when they weren't actually, you know, fighting, because a lot of the time they were doing other things and had time to kill. And it was a loyalty thing to each other. They wrote for each other so that their peers, their friends could read it, the battalion, the regiment, and it would give them a collective unity and consciousness and survival. And do you know something? Some historians have looked at why did these British men particularly not mutiny? Because the French had mutinies, the Russians had huge mutinies.
I won't talk about the bounty mutiny that you connected with, Richard.
Mutiny during the First World War, you know, by and large, there were some deserters, but by and large, Britain had less than some other countries, right? And one of the theories is that the coping mechanism of humour and keeping a brave face was actually what kept them going. So if you understand that thinking behind the cartoons here at the Cartoon Museum, it makes it much more easy to understand where these people were at the time.
And yet it is so extraordinary. I mean, as someone who's never seen action, my father was a major in the Second World War, and obviously I was fascinated to hear of his experiences. But when we talk about the First World War, when we even start to begin to come to terms with what it involved, if you look at the casualty figures, if you read about the conditions in the trenches, the whole thing becomes very, very difficult for us, I think, to communicate with when you look at a mindset. And as you were saying, humour must have been a staple of survival, but so many, of course, did not survive. And it is, I find, very difficult as an anniversary for me to commemorate when the incompetence, the scale of the suffering is so enormous. But that makes this all the more valuable because, as you say, there was a mechanism. Somehow the vast majority did survive in one way or another. And also there were very few, as far as we know, the British side, as you said, mutinies.
That's right. But also, I mean, the reason we have to remember the First World War is to do with it being a watershed in history. It's a turning point from the old to the new, if you like, and it was the starting point for so many things that we understand today. 20th century and 21st century modern medicine, the technology.
Emancipation of women, Jane?
Emancipation of women, a lot of the technology of war, chemical warfare, women getting the vote after the war, a whole number of things. The state providing for people, like welfare during the war. So there's a lot of aspects of history that people forget. It's not just about the losses, which were tremendous. And one of the things that's so amazing about these commemorations is how ordinary people are engaging with it. Groups in Lincoln, for instance, community groups are engaging with the history of the tank, where Lincoln was so important.
There's a university there where they tested it, of course.
Yes, and there's all sorts of people who are discovering their family histories and who are approaching the Cartoon Museum and other museums with things to donate and to offer of their own collections and their own memories. Whenever I make any public appearance, I get loads of queries from people saying, I want to research this, or I want to find out more about this. What should I do? So it has really opened up the whole heritage thing for us in Britain, which I think is a good thing. And we have to face our sad history as well as our achievements.
Jane, you're heading off, or about to head off. Just a quick reminder, what are you going to see this evening? Because Richard might have actually seen the movie. Who knows?
Right, I'm going to the British Library to see a silent movie from 1915 called Pax Eternica.
Not, I have to say, is a movie that I'm familiar with, but do tell us, what is it, what's the theme?
Well,
it's Eternal Peace.
I really don't know. I'll tell you next time, okay?
As ever, Jane, a wonderful cliffhanger. Fantastic connecting with yourself, Jane. We'll see you again very soon.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. And we'll just sort of keep on going. Anita, if we can just move along slightly to this piece, which I found, when I was having a little recce, was a wonderful encapsulation of something which I'm sure, when it was produced, was seen as very disposable, very humorous after a fashion. It's got the caricature elements in there. It's almost like a latter-day spitting image, or an early precursor to spitting image, one should say. I mean, just describe what we see here under the heading Hark, Hark, the Dogs Do Bark, with note by Walter Emmanuel.
Right, this is a map, quite a large-scale map. We've got the original nearby. This is a blow-up of it. And it is it shows Europe. It's produced in 1914. We don't know who the artist is. We know who the publishers were. And in a way, it is following a tradition of satirical maps. Most famous producer was F.W. Rose in the 1870s. He did a number of maps, mostly showing Russia as a giant octopus. Of course, Russia then was the enemy, whereas here we have the Tsar behind the... He's driving a steam roller.
Yes.
And so this, we don't know an exact date, but I think it is very early, because initially the Russians made great advances very rapidly, but then the Germans recovered. So I think it is probably from something like August to September 1914. And we know, here we have the German Dachshund, we have the French Poodle, and of course the British Bulldog with a British sailor, Jolly Jack Tar, holding the British Navy with all these fantastic strings. And of course, that was the naval blockade, which really caused huge problems for the Germans. Obviously, the British also had problems with the U-boats, but really the naval blockade was a key factor in the war. And so this is, you have lots of other figures as well, and we've made it a feature of the Children's Trail for them to actually find all the different animals and also faces of different in different countries throughout the whole of Europe. And one thing I would say is that even though obviously we always refer to it as a world war, and there was fighting in the Middle East and in Turkey and other parts of the country, other parts of the world, essentially it was a European war. And I think this is something which we sometimes forget, that the war, as Jane said, was a real landmark event in many, many ways. And most people, when they look at the history of the 19th century, sort of take 1914 rather than 1900 as the cutoff for the 19th century. But really, when I speak to people who may have been involved in some ways, like, for example, Japan, which was involved in the war, was an ally, Turkey, Germany, India, it is not the same there. In places like India, in Turkey, and in Japan, the commemorations are not anything significant. And obviously in Germany, it's a completely different thing. One of the cartoons that we have in the 1418 now makes the point that in terms of it's showing an old people, group of old people watching a documentary about Verdun. And the woman says, obviously it's a joke cartoon, oh, perhaps at the end of one of these endless documentaries, the Germans will actually win, which is quite funny in some ways. But I think it is a reminder, which we often forget in this country, there was another side who didn't win. They had just as many losses. In some ways, the losses were even greater. All the deaths and also the injuries and all of that, and they had to pay the reparations as well. And who wants to remember or speak about all this loss, and you didn't even win?
Perhaps,
you must remember that. It's really
perhaps
important.
Of course, the message really is, in war, nobody wins.
Indeed.
Richard.
It's a fascinating cartoon, this, because hark, hark, the dogs do bark, and you look at the various animals symbolic of different countries. I mean, one does want to laugh, even though we know what it led to. And the Italian... The country of Italy, it becomes some form of a jackboot, a precursor also of what happened subsequently in the Second World War. And seeing these various animals writhing around, I mean, one remembers from Julius Caesar, Unleash the Dogs of War. I think it's been done splendidly. There's a humorous aspect to it, which is very, very funny. But also looking at this, it's important to remember precisely how sclerotic some of the regimes were in Austria-Hungary, and of course Germany, and interesting too in the exhibition, when you've got somebody as ideal, like the Kaiser, to be caricatured with that moustache and the costumes that he wore and his militaristic attitudes. I mean, a positive gift for the trade.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think that was... I suppose the British had Kitchener, and I'm sure he featured in some early German cartoons. But yes, you're quite right. The Kaiser really was a gift, and even in some of the contemporary cartoons, he features the moustache and his penchant for very elaborate and over-decorated uniforms, and his
shiny breastplates.
Yes, indeed, his. And also some of his comments, obviously, as well, which some of which were actually misattributed to him, this whole reference to the contemptible little army. There is no basis, nobody has ever been able to find a reference to that. So, but it attained a life of its own and became a badge of honor for many of the soldiers who were in that, quote, unquote, contemptible little army, who felt that they were doing very well. Supposedly having been dismissed by the Kaiser, but in holding their own.
I'm intrigued by the narrative that we get in this particular piece, because we've got the Dachshund started by attacking the Belgian Griffon as being the smallest and mauls the poor creature cruelly, but was quite unable to kill her. And he was mistaken as to the others. He found that the dandified poodle could fight, and that the bulldog had not lost the knack of not letting go, and that Russia, after all, was a Russia. And soon the bear idea made the Dachshund tremble. So there's a lot of stuff that's coming through there, which again sort of a subtext to what we actually see visually.
Yes, absolutely. There's so much to look at here, which is why we've done this enlargement for it, because it is easier to see. Obviously, the original map is quite large, but, for example, you've got here on it looks like it could be a Dalmatian. It's a sort of black and white spotted dog, which is being stung by a wasp here just in the Balkans. So, clearly they were...
It's a geographical location as opposed to Anita using some kind of vernacular slang.
Though. No, indeed. It's being attacked on its
front paw as opposed to its Balkans.
Indeed, yes. So it's a really interesting way to actually look at the configuration of Europe at the time and the various, alliances, and then of course the neutrals, because we forget that a lot of countries that were allied differently in the Second World War very often were not directly involved at all, such as Italy or the Netherlands or Denmark or Portugal and Spain, all remained neutral and not directly involved, even though obviously they had their own issues.
And yet, ultimately, the people who actually produced this, I suspect, would not have thought they were doing great art. It wasn't Richard, a bit like somebody who was saying, rather like we heard Michelangelo, etc., saying this is going to be fantastic, phenomenal. It was very disposable popular culture.
Yes, I think, in wartime, propaganda always comes to the fore, which is why cartoons are especially important, and why we were very pleased that 1418 Now, which is the organization overseeing the centenary commemoration, came to us to commission the contemporary cartoons, because, really, it is... When you look at the commemoration of the war, people like Bairn's father or Hazelden or the comic postcards become such a part of the culture of the time, both you know, the men at the front. One of our volunteers sent us some images from an underground museum, I think in Belgium, where as part of the display they had some of Donald McGill's postcards from the time. And of course it was the peak of the postcard period, and people used them all the time, not just the men from the front, but people sending them to each other, sometimes not with any message other than, you know,
still alive.
More they would have said something like, you know, I'll see you for tea this afternoon or something like that. You know, it's like the text message of today, indeed. So, you know, I think it's that part of people's everyday life which was interwoven with the wartime experience. And I think you really get a flavor of people's sense about how long it went on, the food shortages, the things they were doing like knitting scarves or whatever it was, the situation, say, in the Commonwealth, like in Australia, you know, people who are joining up in India or other places as well. So all of those sort of links to the wider imperial world as well as within Britain.
Richard.
And an imperial world, of course, that was soon to collapse when it came to the Austro-Hungarian Empire. What the Germans had, of course, they didn't have many colonies, but what they had, of course, were soon to be lost. And the toppling of thrones, including, of course, Russia, as well as Germany and Austro-Hungary. I mean, it's an extraordinary vision, as you say, of a world, which is quite interesting looking at this cartoon. Tsar Nicholas is behind this sort of steamroller. It wouldn't and didn't take him particularly far if one remembers what actually happened. It's quite ironic to see that he appears to be in the driving seat, so to speak, in this, and we know what occurred in 1917.
And certainly using a steamroller to get from Lincoln to the Cartoon Museum is not advisable, and we wouldn't recommend it. Anita, it's been fabulous touching base with your good self. We've really only covered probably 0.3% of the fabulous material you've actually got here. Thank you very much for your time. I've got a final question. Can we look forward to coming back and seeing you again and doing a slightly more fuller in-depth version on the fabulous work of the Cartoon Museum?
Yes, absolutely. We'd be very happy to let your listeners know a little more about what we do and the different kinds of things they might see when they come here. So, yes, of course.